VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we review a thrilling weekend at the top of the Premier League table as Arsenal take advantage of a dramatic draw at Anfield between Manchester City and Liverpool to sit top of the tree. We'll also discuss the thriller at Villa as John McGinn undoes all our hard work this season building him up and his team get a thrashing by Spurs. We'll also talk West Ham and Wolves, and joining me, Tom Clark, for all of that, we have two of the finest football writers in the land, Alison Rudd and Tom Allnut, and a former footballer who was part of a Chesterfield side who had a brilliant record in title deciders as they won League Two in 2011, securing draws with rivals Shrewsbury and Bury before thumping Wickham 4-1. Gregor Robertson, he knows all about how to win a title, don't you, son?
There's some Super Sundays right there.
Yeah, big time. Tom, seeing as you're not always with us, and Alison is slightly compromised, it's time for my classic Monday morning question after a big Sunday. Liverpool 1, Manchester City 1. Who was this result more important for, and what did we learn most about each team?
Oh, good question, Tom, to start.
Thank you so much, Tom. It's the kind of positivity I want.
I sort of think in the title race, you know, I heard this result was great for Arsenal. I actually think everyone just wants City to lose. I mean, I'm surprised that we kind of think that at this point a draw is good for Arsenal. City have won the title X amount of times. We're expecting them to go on a great run.
You're saying that just to be clear, not because you hate Manchester City, but as a kind of, you know, for the sake of difference.
Yeah, I just think if you're Arsenal, I think you wanted Liverpool to win that game. I think everyone is sort of chasing City. What did we learn? It was a fantastic match. I mean, everyone said that, I think. You know, it's just brilliant quality, end to end. I think Liverpool had the better chances, and definitely in the second half, you know, they had City. You know, you don't often see City like that with a kind of 20-30 minute period where they're really hanging on until Guardiola made those two substitutions of Kovacic and Doku coming on, which I thought made a massive difference. You know, in that last sort of 10-15 minutes, they just really regained the control again. But, you know, those sort of three or four chances that Diaz had were really good chances, you know, and particularly the one where he went through, you know, and opened up his body. And I just thought, for a player of his quality, I thought he should have taken that one. The one that kind of came across to him that was a bit behind him, I actually thought was a bit more difficult. But Liverpool had some great chances in that period. The first half, I thought City were dangerous. Maybe Liverpool kind of had the overall, the better of the game. But I thought City were dangerous as well. You know, they had a really, particularly down the right. It was just a brilliant match. And I think at the end of the game, it was really striking to me to see just how everyone was kind of smiling and happy. And, you know, I mean, and this, I think we will look back on this kind of rivalry between City and Liverpool and think, you know, it reminds me of the kind of Barca-Real Madrid rivalry of, you know, the sort of Mourinho-Guardiola years. You know, the pitch kind of just seems to sparkle. You know, you sort of see all these brilliant players in every single position. But the difference is there's no eye gouging. There's no kind of scrambles and red cards. You know, everyone at the end was just sort of hugging and happy and smiling. And I guess in part, I think that was because of the result, because I think in the way it suited Liverpool and City, everyone was kind of like, okay, we carry on, you know, like we're still in the race, you know, we can keep going. But obviously, equally, I think everyone realises that this has been an incredible match and an incredible rivalry over these last few years.
Alison, to Tom's point about those missed chances, did it feel a little bit like a missed opportunity for Liverpool? Home game, had City on the ropes?
Yeah, whoever gets City on the ropes, who does that? It's so rare to see them wobble like that. And I still think they had periods of great intelligence and tactical nous, but there were, like Tom said, there were also periods where they were wobbling and you think, oh, I don't know, this pressing, this speed, this fearlessness and the chances created and some really defence splitting passing, you think that has to bring reward, and it didn't. So in that sense, I mean, it couldn't have been more different from the game at the Etihad, which was actually frankly quite boring, and I think both teams were very happy for the draw in that game. In this one, I did feel, and yes, you're right, the word compromised, I'm not sure I like that word, Tom, but I was being
mischievous.
Yeah, well, maybe you do have a point, but I felt, whereas both teams were happy with the point at the Etihad, in this instance, I don't think Liverpool were happy with the point at all. I don't think you play like that and take such risks if you don't feel you can win the game. Mm. So to not have done so, and for it to end with controversy, with a foul that could easily have been a penalty, and Klopp's reaction to that proves to me there's no sense at all of, oh, jolly ho ho ho, let's shake hands, wow wow, and we love each other. It wasn't from this Liverool fan anyway.
Mm. Do you think that was a penalty?
Fair enough. I'll tell you what it was, and nobody has said this, it was an indirect free kick in the box. Why are they never given? I am a qualified referee.
Absolutely.
And what you give, what you give in those situations where it's dangerous, but it's not a dangerous foul, it's dangerous play, is you give, if it happens in the box, you give an indirect free kick, because it's not enough for a penalty, but you don't ignore it completely because something has happened.
Have you read the latest sort of IFAB rule book, Alison? Are you sure that's still the law? Because the laws are changing a lot these days.
It's not changed. As far as I'm aware, that's not changed.
To be fair, this was the only thing this game was missing, wasn't it? A last-minute indirect free kick. Can you imagine the carnage? How many players lay on the floor? How many players on the goal line? They're a fantastic thing, an indirect free kick.
I very much doubt Liverpool would have scored from an indirect free kick in that situation. But it was just Klopp. I mean, Klopp afterwards said, what I think most people were saying when they were watching the TV was, oh, if that happens outside the area, it's a free kick. Hmm. So why isn't it a free kick? It's because it's not going to be a penalty, but it should have been a free kick and therefore an indirect free kick.
Let's perhaps be glad, as Tom said, that there's no eye gouging and Jose Mourinho-esque behaviour in this fixture between these two teams and two managers, because that kind of an incident could have got a little bit out of hand. Gregor, what did you make of this game? Firstly, I wanted to give City a bit of credit for that corner routine. You're a bit of the king of the corner routine this season, given all your work and research on Arsenal's efforts. Impressed with that one? Nice little nudge out of the way from Nathan Aki.
Very much, but like subtly as well. You know, people were saying, trying to compare that to the block in the Carabao Cup final, but there was no parallel.
It was masterful, wasn't it? Just a little shuffle.
Yeah, and but the main thing is the execution of that corner. You know, Kevin De Bruyne is one of those rare players who can side foot a pass that's like a shot, as hard as a shot, and as accurate. And it was an incredible delivery. Really smart move, yeah.
Do you think Kelleher should have done a bit better? I thought maybe he just could have been a bit more aggressive or a bit sharper there. I wonder if Alisson would have sort of...
Maybe the surprise element as well. Because you're just like, whoa, what's going on here?
Big surprise, and a player who probably should have been in that area has been sort of, you know, marshalled out of it. So I think that'd be harsh. Kelleher was great again.
He's so calm for someone who's seen so little first team action in the league. I mean, he gets the odd cup run, but geez, I mean, he was so calm. That when that shot, Doku shot hit the woodwork, rebounded,
and
he took it as if he expected that to happen.
Yeah,
it's all right. I'll let it rebound and I'll gather in. That's what I'll do.
I'm sure, not quite sure that was what he was thinking, but no, I couldn't agree with you more. I was watching him in the Europa League game as well against Sparta Prague, and thought again, there was a period where Sparta were kind of having a go at Liverpool, and he was just coming for everything, claiming the ball, falling on it, very very calm. Going back to the game, Gregor, Nathan Ake at Anfield doing a Gregor Robertson. Playing a pass back too short.
Not short, he said. And he played it short, yeah. It's a big, big moment. It tilted the game and, you know, it just gave lift off. It sparked the tsunami, as Guardiola described it. Because what happened after that was remarkable, wasn't it? There was kind of three acts to the game. It was like the City's control in the first half, or for a large part of the first half, Liverpool growing back into it. That moment which sparked the tsunami. And then, as Tom said, the sort of post Kevin De Bruyne dummy spit substitutions, with Kovacic and Doku coming on, sort of exerting a bit of control again, but not complete control. And then the rest of it, which sort of defines this battle, is the conflict between the control of Man City, or the desire for control, and the, you know, just ridiculous energy and emotion of Liverpool. And there was like, and either one could have won it at the end. It was just a brilliant game. Yeah, the biggest takeaway is how much you'll miss it, though.
Mm.
Like, yeah, as Tom said, like, everyone was smiling on the pitch at the end because you think...
Do you think it goes with Klopp, though, if they bring in another good manager?
Yeah, because part of his personality, I mean, his interview afterwards, he's like, he's just pouring everything out to, in front of the microphone, just saying... Going through almost every single player in his team, saying, "Oh my God, Luis Diaz, what was he like with against Kyle Walker? What about that 1v1? The 2v1 towards the end? He's right, that was an incredible moment." And he's just going through every player, Jarrell Kwanzaa, you know, and he's just so genuine.
Mm.
And then even when he was asked to sort of, you know, poked about the sort of mild controversy at the end, the possible penalty, even Klopp this time said, "Listen, this is not the thing we should be talking about after this game. It was an absolute joy of a game, minor controversy, but this was a game of football. Everyone should just enjoy."
Is this a favourite kind of, you know, team manager rivalry from the Premier League years? Because there's been some great ones, and I do feel there's a little bit of like recency bias with these two, where it is brilliant, but they're not always brilliant games. And we've had some real humdingers of rivalries over the years. Wenger and Ferguson, I mean, they were pretty good games. They were always incredible games. And had maybe a little bit more of that needle, which I personally quite like to see.
There's a lot more needle.
I don't want an eye gouge, but I'd like a little bit of little bit less of the whole, "Oh, we love you. No, I love you too. Let's go and play some great football." Anyway. But do we think, is this our favourite? Mourinho.
You're right about the recency bias. But you're right also when there's a sort of dastardly figure like, you know, Mourinho became or even just like Wenger being such an awful loser always.
Mm. I mean, Wenger stood on the in Old Trafford when he went and lost his rag completely when they lost 8-2, was it?
Mm. 7-8-2.
Yeah. And he just stood up. I mean, they were great. That were great years, weren't they?
I think in the early years Wenger really riled Ferguson because Ferguson was like, "Who is this guy from Japan who, you know..." Yeah.
Sort of bloody professor with his glasses.
Well, there's that clip, isn't there, of Ferguson? I think Wenger sort of said something about too much congestion or something, and Ferguson's kind of going on about, "Who is this guy from Japan? You know, when he's in the title race and he's in Europe, you know, maybe he can start talking or whatever." It's really early, and you can tell that he's sort of, there's still this kind of thing about foreigners coming into the Premier League, and it doesn't exist now, but, you know, in those kind of early 90s, it must have been like late 90s, yeah, guess, late early 90s, 2000s. Yeah,
we forget just how much antipathy there was towards Wenger, not just from Ferguson. Everyone was like snooty about his broccoli and his... There were rumours about his personal life. It was horrible.
And
people did not like his difference.
The managers who hadn't played at a really high level, I think, you know. So, you know, obviously post-Mourinho, suddenly, you know, VS Boas and all these other people who came in and suddenly with sort of more of an academic kind of approach to coaching. But in those days, it was like, well, if you haven't played the game, you know, you haven't won anything, like, who are you to kind of come in here and start talking to us? So I think, in terms of Liverpool City, I feel like the teams, it's probably been the best rivalry ever because of the quality. Like, both of them have been right up there, not just in the Premier League, but in Europe as well. You know, both of them have won the Champions League in this time, which wasn't the case with Arsenal and United. And I think in terms of the contrast of their styles, you've got two very attacking teams, but ultimately they're sort of slightly two versions of attacking teams. So it's not kind of a defence versus attack. But I do agree. I sort of think you have to have a bit of needle and the kind of Klopp Guardiola loving. It's been fine, but I think
it's been
pitch,
fine. It's very, very, very well put, Tom. Moving on to other debates. Last week we were debating Phil Foden and the best players in the Premier League, and we had some listeners get in touch. Simon said, "Tom, best player in the Premier League, how about Virgil van Dijk, who is nothing short of excellent to stellar every single game? We just expect it, but that shouldn't detract from just how superb and consistent he is." Alison, would you agree with that?
He's player of the season, and he will be player of the season.
And so he's your best player in the league. You missed this debate last
Monday.
Yeah,
no, he is, but I'm aware that's quite
boring.
He's
player of the season if they win the league.
Do you have to add that qualifier? I don't think that you do. Given that Liverpool are in with a very good chance of winning the league, and they have had a massive injury problem, and there's so many youngsters involved, and the fact they've held it together is thanks to Van Dijk. That's the fact they've made it a title race with all those problems is down to Van Dijk.
I'm absolutely with you. I remember doing a piece like when he won it in 2019, speaking to the other five defenders previously who'd ever won it, and like it's rare. And I would argue even that Diaz winning it since was because of Van Dijk. people, everyone realised that one signing, one huge like figure like that at the back can have such a profound effect on a team.
Also, and potentially, even for Manchester City. if he wins it
for the second time, like he goes ahead of any other defender ever.
Tom, who was your best player in the Premier League at the moment?
If we picked a team to play this weekend,
no,
if I can we pick one player.
If you picked your best player in the Premier League right now.
Right now. It's a slightly boring pick, but I went for Rodri just because I think, like, if you took Van Dijk out of the team, there'd be a huge hole. I agree with that. But I think Rodri even more so for City. And we have actually seen that in a kind of practical sense, that when he didn't play for three or four games earlier in the season, City didn't win any of them or something. I can't remember. And he's obviously got this huge run now at 59 games where he hasn't...
61, I think.
Is it 61?
That's what I said in the paper today.
Yeah, yeah.
Record, you know, for not losing. I just think he's so important to that City team.
And in terms of underrated players, Simon also suggested Joe Gomez plays left back brilliantly, plays right back brilliantly, and plays centre back brilliantly, and can also play in defensive midfield if he wants. No fuss and no fanfare. But what an underrated player.
I don't think he's underrated by Liverpool supporters.
No.
Who all they want is for him to score a goal. That's all they want.
Has he never scored?
No, he's never scored.
Really?
And that's all Liverpool fans want to happen.
You could just see Jürgen giving a penalty at the end of the season, can't you? Disgusting. Sorry, I really, really bought into this narrative of it's all too nice. But Tom, underrated players?
Son. I think he's...
Son?
Well, he's not underrated.
Underrated?
Well, that's underrated.
That's almost as bad as Paul Hurst's shout last week. He said Rodri.
He said
outrageous.
You want a real underrated player? It's Antoine Semenyo from Bournemouth.
Which was Tony Cascarino.
He did see
really?
That, yeah. Yeah.
You and Kaz, man, just
the same
vibing. Other underrated players. Mike, another listener, got in touch and said, Tom, as a Doncaster Rovers fan, I have no dog in this fight. Slightly disappointed he didn't suggest a Doncaster Rovers fan. But surely the most underrated player in the Premier League must be Luton's Alfie Doughty. His left foot delivery with pace and accuracy is probably the best I've seen since the deadly Ian Hart. As a left foot specialist, what does Gregor Robertson think?
I completely agree. He attacks every delivery. It's one of those where he just opens up and he knows it's an area. And playing for Luton Town, where that is very much their sort of blueprint, helps. And he absolutely, as I say, attacks them with a wonderful left foot, 6 assists. There was a period at the start of the season where he was kind of creating chances at a faster rate than any other player in the Premier League, I think. It's quite early in the season, but he's still really, really high. I looked an FB ref this morning and he's like in the 98th percentile for fullbacks in the Premier League for shot creating actions. That's quite a niche stat for you. But it demonstrates that he's very, very creative.
Could see him staying in the Premier League, even if Luton don't?
Possibly. Defensively, I think he's a wing back. I'm not sure whether he could be a left back in a back four and be sort of relied upon defensively enough. But if there's a team playing with a back three as a wing back, good sign.
Well, we've got through a conversation about best players in the Premier League and underrated players without a single mention for Declan Rice and any Arsenal players, which leads me perfectly on to Super Declan and Super Kai Havertz. Maybe he's the most underrated player in the Premier League because he scored a crucial winner for Arsenal against Brentford, which took them top of the table. What's going on with Arsenal, guys? What's going on? Less time last season, everyone's favourite team, blowing people away, we're all excited about them. This season, just because they're doing it again, we don't give a stuff. Everyone's like, oh, Klopp, Pep, every two-horse race. Arsenal, they're just winning every game, coming up against difficult opposition like Brentford. Bloody Brentford, everyone hates playing Brentford, don't they, Alison Rudd?
It's like going to the dentist.
And they still beat them. What's going on, Alison?
What's going on is...
Is this a good thing for Arsenal that we're just kind of slightly just letting them sit
yes,
top of the table?
Yes, very good for them. I don't think they'll like being top of the table, though. This might not be good for them. I think they've really enjoyed sort of buzzing around.
Lurking in third.
At the heels, yapping away at the heels.
Buzzing a bit like Gregor Robertson's laptop, just in case you can hear that in the background.
It won't suit them being top of the league at all. Well, maybe by a marginal amount. But what's happening with Arsenal is... I can't speak for their results away from home, but the atmosphere at the Emirates almost rivaled that of Anfield, I would say. It was the sort of atmosphere where it's you simply cannot do anything but win for that atmosphere. It was overwhelming. And so it was a feverish game. It was incredibly entertaining. two very contrasting styles, but you need players who can ignore the buzz and the noise, and Ødegaard does that, and you only really get a sense of it when you're watching him live. Now, Ødegaard, he prepares sometimes for matches by using a virtual reality gadget, and he asks the people who set up those things to do it at a speed faster than real life, so that when he goes out onto the pitch...
Really?
Yes, really.
Wow.
So when he goes out onto the pitch, for him it slows everything down because he's prepared his brain by having everything going really, really fast. And you can see it was a prime example of how that works for somebody, because it was a mad game. It was completely frenetic. And yet he seems to create a sort of a different space-time continuum around him, and he slows it down, he picks the right ball, he exudes a sort of serenity. And so you've got the help of the crowd and the youth on the pitch, and you've also got him being the ultimate captain, I think, in the way he just makes sure everything is measured, metronomic. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing to watch. So he's not, if you're a fantasy football player, he's probably not the best pick, because I think he gets pre-assist points. Mm. He's the pre-assist or the pre-assist. He's there making sure things are moving in the right direction at the right pace and so on. So I think that's the reason why Arsenal are top of the league and getting through difficult games, is because they can go with the passion and the emotion and the pace and the skill, but they have him. They have him to make sure that it doesn't get out of hand, and he brings absolute incredible intelligence to Arsenal.
And they have Ben White.
Ben White. Another underrated player.
Ben White is turning... Yeah, James Gearbrand wrote about him today in the game, and he, I think rightly so, he could assist for both goals. And you remember back in the start of the season, everyone was saying, why have Arsenal kind of torn up a perfectly good blueprint? Remember? And then, and then trying to get Zinchenko back in the team, and, you know, Zinchenko stepping from left back into midfield. They have evolved again, because now Ben White and Kiwior on the other two fullbacks step inside alongside Jorginho, and they leave two at the back instead of three. So it's kind of 2-3 when they're in possession, as opposed to 3-2, and it's working. Like, Ben White's getting some little inside right positions where he can deliver crosses. He also combines really well with Saka. He's just got a little bit more license, because he was always the guy who was tucking in and allowing Zinchenko to go forward. I think he's been brilliant in recent weeks, and it's sort of, it's like another body in attack, and they're a bit like Spurs, who will come to talk to, I'm sure. They're trusting their two centre-halves, who are great athletes, to deal with whatever comes.
Yeah,
just two of them on their own.
In terms of that atmosphere, Alison, in terms of the way that Arsenal played in this match, it felt a little bit kind of, we talked about those old school 90s, early noughties teams of, in the kind of the way Manchester United sometimes used to play. Get people in the box, put crosses in, you're at home, the crowd, everything, there will be a goal at some point. You know, Declan Rice will fly in, Kai Havertz will fly in, everyone's flying in. Does it have that sense now at the Emirates? Because that, for so long, towards the end of Arsene Wenger's reign and at the start of Mikel Arteta's and stuff, it wasn't like that. It was the opposite, wasn't it? There were groans and moans. Are you saying now that the crowd are so behind them, there's almost a certainty with...
I don't like to say it, but it's true. That's how it felt. They had a fearlessness, not quite at the level of Liverpool's against City, because to be like that against City requires something above and beyond. But there was an overwhelming sense of this is our game. Of course, you've got to add in the Aaron Ramsdale mistake.
Mm.
And that was palpable as well, that they didn't, the fans and the players who went into a huddle afterwards, did not want the game to be defined, and indeed the title race defined, by a terrible goalkeeping mistake from someone who's hugely popular but doesn't get in the team anymore.
Yes, exactly. Well, I'm going to contradict myself here with having said, slagged off Klopp and Pep and all the loving. I was absolutely delighted that didn't cost Arsenal, because I really like Aaron Ramsdale. He seems like a lovely
player. I don't think anybody wanted it. I mean, the Brentford fans gave him a bit of stick, but other than that, yeah, there was this overwhelming sense of plea, and he did redeem himself. We would have seen Ivan Toney's half volley from virtually the halfway line.
How good was that, though?
Was so beautiful. It would have been goal of the season.
Oh.
It would have been, because it was. I've never seen anyone try and take the ball like that, and it swerved in the air.
Yeah.
Amazing! It was amazing, and Ramsdale was able to readjust his body. And I mean, it wasn't like the hardest save in the world, but it felt like redemption.
It was a header that was almost the better save, I think, in the second half too.
But it does show, doesn't it, that we were writing pages and pages about the Ramsdale Rea thing earlier in the season, and whether, you know, suddenly Arteta discovered this new thing that no one's thought of.
We'd rotating have, goalkeepers.
Know, two keepers. But actually it's not possible. You know, like, you bring in someone like Ramsdale now, and he knows he's number two. He knows he's got to play. He knows he's probably leaving the summer. He's got all this pressure and spotlight on him. And it's not a surprise to me that he makes a mistake. You know, I mean, it's we talk about ripping up blueprints, and I agree that most of the things Arteta has done this season have been good. And we can probably say that David Rea is an upgrade on Ramsdale. I think he's been excellent in recent weeks. But there's no doubt he's ruined Ramsdale for now. You know? I mean, Ramsdale looks nowhere near the keeper he was last season.
So great way to find a way to dig Miguel Arteta here.
Also, where does he go?
This model hasn't worked, has it? Not for Ramsdale, anyway. For Arsenal.
Where does he go? Where's Ramsdale's next? I was speaking about this with someone at the weekend. Like, I can't pick the team.
But
do you think he has to leave?
He's a better keeper than he was. Before he made the mistake, which was at the end of the first half, before he made the mistake, he was distributing beautifully. He was Rea-esque. He was thinking about
he's
where
not
he put the
Rea-esque
ball.
Though. Yeah,
but
I understand what you're saying.
He's tried really hard to improve that area of his game.
The thing you saw the reason why they signed Rea in that mistake, because what he does is he receives the ball, controls it, and opens up. Rea is like an outfield player. He's like really kind of fluid in his movement. He's like in one movement he opens up and he plays that ball quicker. Everything's just a little bit kind of stodgy and like.
It might be because I've been up north for 5 days and I'm going a bit old school and old blokey and wanting people to scrap rather than be nice to each other. But also, in terms of a goalkeeper, is Ramsdale not a better shot stopper in a traditional sense? You know, that old thing that keepers used to have to do, you know what I mean? None of this passing nonsense. Is he not? I think he is.
He's
a better shot stopper. If you had someone to save shots from Ivan Toney and the great strikers in the Premier League, I'd pick Ramsdale over Rea.
Yeah, I think you're probably right, yeah. Although I think he also does have the occasional howler.
Fair enough. Tom, finishing off on Arsenal, they've got away games to come against Manchester City, Tottenham, Brighton, Wolves and Manchester United. They're in a great position, but coming to back to Alisson's point about where you are in the race, whether you're lurking at the back, waiting to strike, now they're at the top. They've got this game against Porto, then a break before that game against City. Does the pressure start to build again? The expectations start to mount?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, those are really tough away games. You know, all four of those are difficult away games. It's interesting what Alisson was saying, because I sort of saw it a little bit differently, but I wasn't there. So
you weren't there, man.
But this thing of, like, you know, the overwhelming, the sort of desperation to score. I didn't see this match as a sort of a... didn't make me think Arsenal were going to win the league more, I have to say, because I think it's a slight reminder of that last season thing where things get frantic and things get nervy. And I wish Arsenal played these kind of games when they make a mistake and they get a setback as if they were the third in the Premier League in the title race. You know, we have nothing to lose. We're not under pressure, you know, and we can play and keep control, etc. But there's this sort of, they get frantic and they get edgy and everything becomes a bit kind of forced. And
How's the frantic different to the City-Liverpool frantic?
Yeah.
What's different about it?
I mean, I think it's interesting if you compare it, for example, with Anfield, where everything is kind of, you know, we talk about the noise, but I think there's a more of a confidence. It's more like, we know we're going to swarm over them and we know we're going to score and create a whole host of chances. Arsenal, it gets a little bit desperate almost. You know, we're appealing for sort of slightly penalties that aren't. You know, we're kind of starting to sling things in the box. I think they just lose themselves a little bit in those moments. And it reminds me of last season when we were talking about those brilliant last-gasp wins. But you can only go to that well so often, you know. And we've been talking a lot in recent weeks about Arsenal scoring, you know, 50 goals in four games, whatever it was. And they were really, really impressive in those games. There's no, when Arsenal are playing brilliantly, there's probably not a better team in the league. But in these moments, you know, when it's kind of 1-1 and you've had a penalty against you or something, I would back Liverpool and City to score the kind of, to handle that last 20 minutes better. And I just wonder if when it kind of comes to the crunch in this run in the last kind of five games, and it might even go to the last one or two games, if it goes to the last day of the season and we've got all three teams trying to get a goal, I would back City and Liverpool to do that better than Arsenal. I just think they still have that kind of composure and confidence, whereas...
Which is why Odegaard is so important. If they didn't have him, they'd be a bit of a mess sometimes, I think.
Mm. Right, games to go then. 10 of them. Who's going to win the league? One word.
Bloody dreading this.
One word. You knew it was coming, mate. How long have we been doing this?
But of all the weeks to not ask this question, surely
this is
the week.
That's exactly why I'm asking it. That's exactly why I'm asking it. Go on, one word. Just pick a team, for goodness sake. I'll go first. Arsenal. There you go. Now you can all pick the more obvious ones. Boring.
I would say City, but my faith has been eroded this weekend.
Faith has been eroded. Tough for Pep Guardiola when he's listening back to
this. I know,
yeah,
you really got it.
Alison?
Oh, let me think. Oh, Liverpool.
Very good. Tom?
Why is your faith being eroded? I mean, it's a good point at Anfield, isn't it? I mean, just because of the way they played or...
I don't know. I really
now
don't
you've
know
asked him
answer.
Another tough question, for goodness really sake. It was answer. Bad enough the first
I feel
time.
Like there's some kind of force behind Liverpool and Arsenal for all. I actually agree with what you were saying there. I kind of sensed that. Although, look, Alison was the one of us in this room who was at the game, so she could get a
yeah,
bit
you
of grasp
there,
of
man.
What was happening. But I kind of got that feeling a bit more. Maybe it's just a reminder of those games last season when it was frantic and it was really desperate. But I just think Arsenal have got kind of ridiculous power now.
Arsenal
as well.
Or Liverpool?
No, Arsenal have got real power behind them. And
so hang on, you think Liverpool's got power, Arsenal, but you're saying City?
Yeah.
You'd make a great politician, sense, you, Greg. Tom, final word.
I think Arsenal will win it.
Arsenal?
Yeah.
You just slagged them off.
Yeah, yeah. I have my doubts, but I think they'll win it.
Two votes for Arsenal. There you go, Arsenal fans. That's why you should listen to the game podcast. If you're like Simon or Mike, those listeners who got in touch, and you've got views to share, either on who's going to win the title, or maybe you're shocked that we haven't discussed Lincoln City's 5-1 trouncing of Barnsley in League One this weekend, you can get in touch with me, tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. But for now, stick with us. Up next, we're talking Villa and Spurs.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes. Without the ads.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host Luke Jones for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Tom Clark, and today I'm joined by Alison Rudd, Tom Allnutt, and Gregor Robertson to the Game Podcast Premier League Derby as Aston Villa. Everyone's two favourite teams, Aston Villa and Tottenham Hotspur, faced off at Villa Park. Wasn't quite the end-to-end battle we were expecting, Gregor. After your mate John McGinn ruined everything with a reckless challenge. Definite red for you?
Yeah, you can't just boot someone, can
you? Oh, I thought you were going to try and defend him.
It's on the kind of fence, but I think...
You're going to go orange card on me?
No, it was a red. You can't just volley someone like that, I'm afraid, anymore.
Not anymore.
More's the pity.
Now we're talking. Get the old man grumbling going. But what did you make of the game before that? Was this the right result regardless of the red card?
I mean,
was Tottenham the better team?
Yeah, but it wasn't a 4-0. I don't think it was probably a 4-0. But Spurs play the most extreme football in the country. It's incredible, isn't it? I know I just referenced it with Arsenal. It's more controlled. Although they still leave two men at the back and trust them to deal with whatever comes their way. Spurs just leave them completely wide open. There's no team that supports the press as
recklessly.
Recklessly. That's a good word to use. Yeah, and you know, with their fullbacks playing as number tens or whatever. But when you've got someone of Van Ven's pace at the back, although obviously his hamstring injury could be really, really, really costly for them, and Romero when he's in this form, they just kind of trusted themselves to back themselves to deal with
even a player of Ollie Watkins' pace and sort of qualities.
Just very quickly, spinning off that idea, talking about Van Dijk and Diaz and things, do you think because of this way that teams are wanting to play with fullbacks pushed very high, it's creating a breed of centre-back that is your, like, Superman centre-back? You have to be quick, you have to be strong, you have to be good
Absolutely.
At the ball, you have to recover everything, you have to be able to tackle, you have to be calm, composed. You've got to be super. Everyone needs a Superman as centre-back, don't they?
Absolutely. It's been that way for a while. I mean, Liverpool probably, you know, they were the same, because when Trent Alexander-Arnold and Andy Robertson, you know, were bombing up and down the line, obviously that's changed a little bit now. They did the same, really. The difference is, a lot of teams obviously have a holding midfielder who kind of sits on front, and they've got like a sort of defensive triangle, a defensive block there. Spurs don't really even have that, do they? I mean, they have players who kind of nominally play in that position, but they can advance forward as well. It really is 2v2 at the back a lot of the time. Look, I know they won 4-0 and I'm concentrating on the second half, but that was a big theme of the game.
Listen, mate, you're like a former defender. That's what you're here to do.
That was a big theme of the game. It's just the way that Aston Villa sort of tweaked the way they play as well, and they kind of sat a little bit deeper, and I think tried to exploit that in the knowledge that Spurs would come and play that way. It was like both teams backed themselves to be better, and ultimately it was Spurs who came out on top.
Alison, what do you make of this game?
Well, I disagree slightly the way you phrased that, the end of that. I felt the reason Spurs won was because they believed in themselves more than Villa did. So it was a very even first half. It was strange. It was interesting, but there was very little goal mouth action. And it was quite tentative, as though they were working each other out, if they liked their systems or not. And then it felt like after the interval, Ange Postecoglou probably said, "Okay, we've got this. We've got this, guys. We are."
Was that a start?
I think it was.
No, you
gave up.
You
believe in yourself.
Go on.
I didn't believe in myself.
Oh, look, guys,
and
come
I
on.
I lost 4-0. Yeah. So, but I that's how it looked. It looked like, what's the point of all this cagey rubbish? Let's just be us. We've got most of our key players back. Let's go for it. You know, let's get Son more involved. That underrated player that nobody knows about. and that's what happened. They, in the second half, Spurs just thought, not interested in a point. We know how good we are.
They're never interested in a point.
No, true. But in this instance, I think Villa were. I think Villa were slightly interested in a point. I didn't think they played with the freedom we have often seen from them at Villa Park, where a lot of that early season run where they were unstoppable at home was not because they had the best players on the pitch always. It was because they believed in themselves. They believed in their pace. They believed they could score at the end of a move. They just believed it, and they swept aside opponents, and Spurs did that number on them.
Tom, what do you make of that idea that Unai Emery maybe slightly got this wrong in a big game? And how does that relate to his career generally, having followed him quite a lot in his time in Spain?
Yeah, I mean, that was actually my take as well, what Alison said, because I wonder if he sort of looked at Spurs' recent games where they played against lesser teams who have dropped deep, and Spurs have really struggled to kind of break them down. It was Brentford, was it? No, it was Palace, wasn't it, last week, where Palace just dropped in and played sort of 10, 11 men behind the ball, and Spurs could hardly, you know, create a chance, you know, and Palace got one on the break. And I wonder if Emery, being such a kind of homework nerd, he probably looked into all this and thought, this is the way to beat Spurs, you know, not to kind of create an end-to-end pinball match, you know. But they're also
great on the counter. They're great cutting through teams and exploiting.
That's true.
So there's theory behind it.
I agree with that, yeah. But I think they've been more positive, particularly at home, than what I saw here. I thought they dropped deeper than they have done before. And I think, I agree with Alice, I think they were just a little bit more kind of passive, and actually I would have liked to have seen Villa been more kind of, we're at home here, we're 5 points ahead, we win this game, we finish in the top four. And I thought whether it was about settling for a point, or whether it was Emery kind of thinking, okay, this is how we can beat Spurs by playing more on the break and letting them have all of the ball, I don't know. But I think it sort of backfired a bit. And it does, I mean, I'm a huge fan of Unai Emery. I mean, I think if you look at the two teams, for example, I was sort of thinking about it before the game, I don't really know how many Villa players would get into Tottenham's starting 11. You'd have Watkins, of course, Douglas Luiz, maybe Emi Martinez, perhaps, but not that many.
John McGinn,
yes. Which is a testament to the job he's done, no doubt about that. I love Unai Emery. But there is a thing in his career, I think, when his teams play better teams, he reacts rather than proacts, you know. And I think
this could have been an example there where we've seen him think, okay, how is the best team, how is the best way to play to kind of nullify Spurs, rather than thinking, we're the better team here, let's stamp our authority on the game.
Is there a Europa League, Europa Conference League factor here, maybe? Obviously having that game against Ajax. I was interested talking about that team, talking about those players, seeing what kind of a quite a strong team that he put out in that game. Is that a factor, maybe, for Unai Emery?
Possibly, and Spurs have hardly played any games this season at all. I mean, yeah, you know, they played about 40 games, aren't they, by the end of the season? So I think that could definitely be a factor in the running. And Spurs are getting players back. You know, I mean, they've had players back now for a month or so, but I thought Maddison looked as close as I've seen him in recent weeks to his kind of early season form. You know, that goal where he scored in the box was, you know, it was a good finish. It wasn't kind of a typical Maddison goal by any means, but I thought the fact that he was there and he'd actually made that run to kind of get ahead of whoever the Villa defender was kind of symptomatic of his performance, because he just seemed to have more energy, more sharpness. And Tottenham have had, you know, three or four pretty key players back now for a few weeks, but they haven't quite sort of got that rhythm back. But I think they look like they're now kind of hitting their stride again.
Greg, do you agree with that in terms of Ange Postecoglou? Went through that period where we all thought, oh, here we go, here's the fall away, they're going to fall away. Brought them back.
Never really did,
yeah, exactly. Kept them in it with lots of players, you know, Brian Gill and people plucked from obscurity to come and do a job, waiting for these stars to come back. And now we're into March, into the run-in.
And they look like that. I mean, that, look, again, Van Veen's injury would be a huge loss, but that looks pretty close. Tom, would you not agree to their best team?
They've got everyone available now, pretty much, yeah.
I absolutely love watching them. I know it's like, Tom used the word reckless, and that probably is the right word. It's kind of, it's so risk and reward. But when you have the belief, and when you kind of, you commit to it 100%, and that is, again, it's about committing to backing up the press, just having all your players almost in the kind of the opposition's final third, even when you don't, like, when you don't have the ball. it's so alien to any sort of game I ever played, or anyone really, probably until about 10 years ago. And it's so extreme, as I say. I think it's the most sort of extreme example of this that there is in the Premier League, because of the way the fullbacks play as well. The fullback, Udogie was brilliant again. The way he can carry the ball out of defence, or kind of turn up in number 10 positions, is incredible. So
it was interesting last week, because Postecoglou was talking about sort of referencing the injuries to his kind of training methods and his style, and maybe kind of he was hinting at the idea that at the end of the season we need to look at this and not just kind of say all the injuries have been a one-off, that actually maybe we need to kind of refine some of our methods. And whether that was just kind of talking about the kind of training volume and intensity, or whether he was actually kind of saying maybe some of the, you know, high octane, ridiculous amount of sprints that we're doing is having an effect on the fitness of the squad, I think would be interesting, because we're seeing right now kind of pure Postecoglou, plan A Postecoglou, whether over the course of time, over 2 or 3 years,
he might
10%
might have
off.
A plan B, surely not.
He might just pull that back. I don't know. I mean, we know he said
don't
many
do it
times.
To his hand. Don't do it.
He said many times he won't do that, but I thought it was an interesting idea.
Thinking about those fixtures, it's absolutely fascinating looking at both teams have the top three to play. Tottenham play them back to back. They have City and Arsenal at home, and then away at Liverpool end of April and May. So not only could they have a big impact on the title race themselves, but also when it comes to the fourth place, Gregor, you know where I'm going. I'm going to be upset about this one as well.
Yeah, I thought you were better than this, Tom.
Okay, but fine. Won't ask you then. Alison, who's going to finish fourth?
Spurs.
Why?
Well,
because they've got a game in hand.
They have nothing else to play for. They have the better play. They have a lot of very good players. And they have a manager who enjoys making them just do what they want, do best. They sort of deserved to be fourth for that reason, I think, because it's quite refreshing. Just have a group of...
You're going to let Aston Villa have the Conference League as a compensation?
I think...
Might be a bit too far. Tough for Villa fans, this.
No, I mean, I feel they don't deserve to finish fourth. I do feel bad for Villa, because Tom's spot on. That, I mean, if you look at the two teams, 4-0 doesn't look ridiculous, but they've been punching above their weight. They've been greater than the sum of their parts, and I think this will be a knock. They've had a few knocks. This will be a knock to their confidence that they can. They need to do what Spurs do, and really have kept that early momentum going, and it's a really hard thing to do. Well, it's almost impossible for Spurs not to keep a momentum going now, because they've got nothing to interrupt it, and they don't mind playing the big teams. They enjoy it.
Tom?
Yeah, I think the lack of Europe, and I think Spurs have got slightly easier fixtures. Villa have got kind of a little cluster of all those awkward teams in the middle, Wolves, Palace, I think Brighton as well. But I actually think it's worth saying as well, I don't think it's the be-all and end-all, you know, for Villa finishing fourth, or Spurs, if I'm honest. Like, I think we've all been...
Of course, fifth could be Champions League.
Fifth as well could be Champions League. I think it's slightly less likely now, isn't it, after the kind of midweek fixtures. But I do think we're all kind of conditioned to be extremely excited about the kind of top four race and what it means, because it's sort of a, you know, television creation. But actually, Villa have had an amazing season. They're on a brilliant trajectory. They're kind of creating this team under Emery. I think them finishing fifth or sixth is fine, you know. And the Premier League these days, it's not like it was 10 years ago, where you finish in the Champions League and suddenly you can go out and sign a 40, 50 million player, and you couldn't if you finish in the Europa League. Excuse me. The Premier League now has so much wealth and so much dominance that you can finish seventh and still sign really good players from Spain and Italy. You can build some really good signings on that. And actually, maybe there's a case to say that if Villa finish fourth this year and get in the Champions League, it might even be too soon. Like, we know what Newcastle did, we know what United did, and it didn't come to anything. Just because you finish in the Champions League doesn't necessarily mean you're suddenly going to challenge for the title the year after. So I actually think maybe it would be all right if Villa don't get in the top four.
Postecoglou said something similar recently as well, didn't he? He said, like, you know, the journey's kind of more important than the development, sorry, the team. Like, what's the point of getting in the Champions League if you're not like ready to do it, basically? And the last few times Spurs have been in the Champions League, it's been miserable, really. So I kind of agree with that. I mean, I'm not sure whether everyone.
Do you want to have your say on who's going to do it? You don't have to. I don't want to pressure you. No,
that's Spurs fine. Just.
Spurs just. I think Spurs
then
just.
Again, it's recency bias. I don't know.
He's lost it completely. We hope you're going to have to regain your composure, because we're coming to you next. We're going to do a quick whiz through of the rest of the weekend's action, starting at West Ham. And who was there for us? Gregor Robertson. Tell us
the real big game of the Super Sunday.
Yeah, the real big game of Super Sunday. West Ham 2, Burnley 2. Burnley contriving to throw away a win again.
Yeah. Yeah, I kind of thought it was a absolutely wild end to the game. Like, wild 9 minutes of stoppage time.
Having been an abject first half, as you
described. Like, West Ham were woeful in the first half. Burnley scored an absolute peach in Fofana in the 11th minute, and then West Ham gifted them an own goal just before half time. You thought, crikey, Burnley might win a game here. First game, I think, since December 23rd. And then, like, within a minute of the restart, just some more calamitous defending. Like, failed to win a header, failed to win the knockdown, and then I think Estevez kind of just like lunged in at Paqueta, and suddenly Paqueta was clean through and he scored, and that was it. The London Stadium.
Burnley's Alisson Rudditis that she predicted in our pre-season preview.
Well, yeah. So, and then even, you know, Danny Ings came on. Danny Ings was probably man of the match, and he came on the 82nd minute. Seriously, he rattled the crossbar with a volley. He scored a goal that was chalked off for offside, really, really marginal offside by VAR. And, you know, that was another warning for Burnley. Like, right, crikey, we got away with one there. And then 91st minute, Danny Ings pounces again. And Burnley still could have won it. They had two great chances. Berger had a chance, and he kind of showed a good bit of composure for another chance in the 99th minute, laid it off to Brownhill, and Areola rushed out and blocked it brilliantly. So, yeah, like a really slow burner, but it ended up being a thrilling end to the game. And I think I said in this piece, it kind of sums up both teams. West Ham, they take more knocks than they would, more setbacks than they would really, you know, ideally like. They're experiencing quite a lot. There's no like consistency for West Ham, really, despite them being, what are they, seventh or eighth?
Seventh, yeah.
That's still the sense of what their season is. They take huge setbacks. David Moyes' future comes under question, and then they respond, and they responded in the second half. So they do always find a response. Burnley just always find a way not to win the game. So like that really the kind of final 9 minutes summed up that their seasons.
Well, you mentioned it there. One of the favourite topics of this podcast, along with how much we love Ange Postecoglou and Jurgen Klopp and all that nonsense, is West Ham and David Moyes. Tom, you were in Germany for Freiburg's 1-0 win against West Ham in the Europa League on Thursday. Where do we think Moyes is going here? Where do we think West Ham are going if we had to? Greg has riled me up about my desire for predictions, so I'm going to ask for more. Will David Moyes be the West Ham manager at the start of next season?
I don't know. I mean, they weren't great in midweek. They lost 1-0, and to be honest, they deserved to lose.
I mean, it's weird because they had those two wins against, what was it, Everton and Brentford?
Yeah, Everton and Brentford.
And
yeah.
You sort of thought, okay, you know, they
after the hammering by Arsenal, yeah.
Yeah, and they hadn't won for about eight games. Got hammered by Arsenal. They lost 3-0 to United. And then you think, well, those two wins are kind of going to pick up, you know. And as you said, you sort of think, well, the end of the season's going to, you know, Moyes in and everything's going to be fine. But then these two matches, 2-0 down at Burnley at half time, I just think. The problem is with West Ham is that there's no kind of sense of trajectory anymore. There's no sense of a to use a better word, project. You know, it's all very much kind of week to week. You know, and when the football isn't great, and I actually think it's a bit overrated this whole thing about West Ham playing terrible football. When they've been playing well, I think they've been quite good to watch. But this season it has been very turgid, and what that creates is this kind of sense of every result matters, because as soon as you're playing boring football. If you don't win, then everyone's extremely upset about that. And that's what it sort of feels almost like Antonio Conte-ish, where it's sort of week-to-week crisis or excellent, you know, crisis or excellent. And here we are again, and it just sort of feels, to me, it feels unsustainable, you know. And I have some sympathy for the West Ham fans because, on the one hand, you know, you think about everything that's happened in Europe and they have these brilliant European trips and they could do well still. You know, I expect them to still probably to turn it around against Freiburg. But equally, they go every week. And they're not seeing a team that is really progressing. And they've got some good players, you know. They've got some good players now. Paquetá, you know, Bowen, Ward-Prowse. They've got some really good Kudus. Creators in there. Kudus is a
great.
Yeah, lovely player. And they're not really seeing them gel or fire. And I just wonder if it might be best for everyone at the end of the season if they say, OK, let's split. It's been good, but let's leave it there.
Time to move on. Alison Rudd.
West Ham are a mirage. People see what they want to see and it's not there. It's ridiculous. In one breath, Tom says...
I knew we'd miss this. I knew we went straight through a far too normal a conversation early on in the first half. We didn't have an Alison Rudd kind of, you know, analogy. And finally, we've waited 50 minutes and it's here. Sorry, carry on.
In one breath, Tom will say, finishing seventh for Aston Villa wouldn't be no bad thing. Might be a good thing. You don't want to get the Champions League place too soon. And it looks like West Ham are on course to finish around seventh. And suddenly, for some reason, this is a terrible thing. I think that's an absolutely outrageously good thing for a club like West Ham, who don't consistently get the backing and have had European competition year upon year and actually won one of them. I think they are overachieving. They aren't always beautiful, but they are often entertaining and occasionally beautiful. Danny Ings' winning goal was beautiful. Was a beautiful goal. They produce moments of beauty.
When Jared
Bowen's feeling it, he looks unstoppable and one of the best players in the Premier League. And it's annoying that I'm sure it's annoying if you're a West Ham fan that it can't be like that every week. But of course, it can't be like that every week. And why when they have a dip, which I think is a natural thing to have, it suddenly looks ugly, and David Moyes looks old and miserable and without any tactical acuity. Why that should suddenly be the case, I don't know. They are their own worst enemies. If they just gave the team the sort of support they do give them when they're on a European run, for example, they could easily finish.
There was no support in that first half, honest to God. It was like, and it's one of those afternoons where you're reminded that this is not a football stadium.
Yes,
and there's the murmur of chatter, and yeah. It's like, oh my God, what is happening here?
Which makes their success
empty seats,
all the better.
And they boo, and as soon as the own goal went, and they're all charging for the exits, and there's real boos at half time. That's how easy it is to flip, despite all of that. So, all I'm saying is the eternal David Moyes conflict is not solved by him signing a new contract. It's just extending it forever.
A contract extension, a misery extension, a quandary extension.
Well, it's not a misery extension. That's the conflict. It's like there's been a lot of joys and some achievement.
It's an extension of us
right,
having this debate on this podcast. That's
Arsenal,
basically, I think we've
Arsenal,
had it a lot.
Arsenal,
so.
Top of the league. Arsenal's main problem under Arteta was originally that fans would leave after 60 minutes if it wasn't going their way. They were moody and miserable and did not give them the support. They created a new anthem. The fans have been told, you've got to be behind us whatever happens. They have completely U-turned. The atmosphere at the Emirates, it's gone from absolutely ridiculous to sublime, and it's been partly engineered. If West Ham fans did something similar, that their team would produce better football. Get a grip, that's what I say.
But it's engineered, Alison, because, you know, those fans wouldn't be singing and shouting at the Emirates if they weren't playing well. I mean, they're playing good football. Arsenal is a great team to watch now. They create loads of chances. They're, you know, they're probably the best team to watch in the country.
They were never shite, though, when they were leaving in 60 minutes.
But it got a bit boring. And I do think...
Very childish of me to laugh at the word shite, but I enjoyed it. It came out of left field.
The thing with fans is that, I mean, I always think the sort of satisfaction with teams is not about where they are, it's about sort of the where they're going, isn't it? It's the trajectory. Like Arsenal can finish fourth for 10 years in a row, whatever it was, and people got bored because they got the sense that we're not going anywhere, you know? And but they were happier under Arteta when they finished sixth because the idea was, okay, we're back on the way up, you know? And the problem is with West Ham, I agree, finishing seventh for West Ham is a good result. But it's about the sense of we're not going anywhere. We're just plodding. Every week is the same and it's a bit turgid. We're not taking it two teams. We're not going to get any chance of maybe finishing the top five. And to some extent, I agree, it's slightly irrational because they'll probably bring in a new coach and it could get worse in terms of the position. But it's about excitement. It's about connection. And I also think, in a way, the thing with Moyes is there's never been this sense that he's a West Ham man. And I don't think he thinks he's a West Ham man either, that he's sort of doing a job. And the West Ham fans think he's doing a job, and it's sort of it's a manager convenience. I mean, remember Bilic, for example, was at West Ham. He played terrible football, but everyone was behind him almost until the end because there's a sense that he's one of us. Whereas I think Moyes, he's not one of them. And I just wonder if it's always going to be like that until they get someone.
Time for Mark Noble, is that what you're saying?
Time for Mark Noble.
Time for Mark Noble. Well, one team that are definitely going in the right direction and feel like they have a plan are Wolves. And Gary O'Neill. Could we have Gary O'Neill at West Ham? Why aren't they sneaking in? Contract talks potentially on the table at Wolves. What else is there nice thing to say about Gary O'Neill? Have we got anything left to say? They're magnificent, aren't they, Wolves? They're up to... Where are they up to? Doesn't matter where we finish in the table, does it, Tom Allnutt? But they are seventh. That's pretty good.
He'll be in the conversation for Manager of the Year, won't he?
Is everyone seventh?
No, sorry. Wolves are eighth. I got that wrong. Yeah, West Ham are seventh. Sorry.
Thank you.
He'll be up there. I don't think
he's got to be, yes.
Yeah, I mean, he's done a fantastic job, no doubt. I mean, Wolves are very well organised, play really good football. There was this idea under Lopetegui they were kind of slightly turgid and boring and defensive, but they got good results. That's not the case anymore. You know, he's done that thing which I think a lot of managers struggle to do, which is to oversee a quick and dramatic change in style whilst also getting results. You know, we've seen that with Bournemouth, for example, under Iraola this season. It's not always easy to do that, you know. And yeah, I mean, we can't really say anything more about him.
He'd be mad to sign a new contract, though, wouldn't he, with the merry-go-round that's about to happen? Because there could be all sorts of opportunities coming. You know, let's say Liverpool's or Manchester United, if they're looking for a new manager, start picking at De Zerbis and these people of the world. Gary O'Neill just needs to sit there and wait for the phone to ring, doesn't he, Gregor?
I think the phone will ring whether he signs a new contract or not, eventually, because I think he's a star. I think, the way he sets up his team is they're so hard to play against. And he's been quite kind of, you know, he's seen what he has at his disposal as well and brought the best out of it. We all thought there was no goals in the team, and he's, you know, he got Huang firing, he got Cunha, finding his shooting boots and just tweaked his position a little bit. I think he played him off the left a bit more. Neto's been playing superbly, although his injury again. And the number of injuries they had in this game as well. They lost Bellegarde and Neto in this game. They're playing a 19-year-old kid up front, Fraser. I think Lamina and Gomez, you could put both of them in the underrated category as well. They are an outstanding pairing in the way that they kind of rat around. They protect the back four, but they're also great, really proactive in the press at the times, the moments they go and press as well. And Ike Nouri as well. I mean, he started as left back, ended up on the right wing. Great little shuffles of feet, brilliant ball carrier. So they've got some good players, but he's really, really, really brought the best out of them all as well. And yeah, as I say, I think Gary O'Neill has got a very, very bright, very bright future.
Will he be at Wolves next season, Alison Rudd?
It's hard to see.
Don't you turn against me now, asking for a prediction? Come on.
He doesn't live in the Midlands.
No, as Tony often says.
So the temptation must be for an easier life, get up an hour later in the morning.
He's spent time in Liverpool's academy. I think it's easy to say that. I think, you know, he's probably quite dedicated to his job.
West Ham, I'm telling you, I can see it coming.
West Ham would be...
But is he going to be there? No, you don't think so?
I feel mean saying it, because I'm sure Wolves fans will think that's awful, because he's been such a hit. But he has qualities that so many teams need. He's very, very good at assessing his squad and working out how to get the best from individuals. He's a great man manager. He's really good at the talking to the players and saying...
Do you have him at Liverpool? Once Xabi goes to Bayern Munich?
I had a very, very detailed dream about Xabi Alonso, actually. I almost phoned the desk to say, do you want me to write up my dream for the paper? But I didn't, because I figured they might think I was turning slightly...
Even more mad than you are already?
Yeah. But
so no, you wouldn't have him at Liverpool?
No, he's not ready for Liverpool.
Okay. What was the dream?
It was very long.
tell it in 5 seconds.
5 seconds. Xavi was obsessed with he had he doesn't, but in the dream he had coaching academies all over the world. But in Greece he was having problems with players not turning up for training because of religious reasons.
That is very specific. There you go. What a way to end Monday's podcast there. Predictions galore and a dream about Xabi Alonso. Alison Rudd, Tom Allnutt and Gregor Robertson, thank you very much for joining me. Thank you too for listening. We'll be back on Thursday with Martin Samuel and Gregor to talk about the Champions League action.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.